It was what I was doing high-end residential. It wasn't really a corporate thing, but what you're dealing with is the people who run these type of places. And it wasn't satisfying, man. Like, some of those clients were good people, but some of them were not. Some of them were demanding in an unfair way. Some of them, you can tell that their hearts weren't in the right place and it just didn't feel right, you know. I would see them buy a dining table that was my salary for the year, and it just didn't feel good. It was creative. That's what I love about it. And you know, that's what kept me in it for so long, was that the creative part of it. But it just didn't, I saw the way I was dressing every day and I was trying to become something that I really wasn't, and I never felt comfortable. And it's almost like every time I've done that, where I've tried to fit in somewhere, it never works out. Like, you gotta figure out a place where you could just 100% be yourself.
Another week, another episode of Rel and Friends. And I am Rel, and this is the podcast where I interview all of my many friends in the creative world, those who do creative things for fun and for a living. And today's a special one, man, because I'm interviewing my boy, Ray Herrera. He is a designer and creative director, art director. He comes from a background of traditional art and graphic design work, but has an emphasis in architecture, architectural design, interior design. And he does some really cool things. I'll share his Instagram page here. It is at Raid Roach Killa, RAIDROACHKILLA. Great designs, man. This is a new space we're entering on this podcast, a new creative journey that we're going on right now. So I hope you guys enjoy this one. I soak up a lot of knowledge, and he also has a background in event, which is fitting because all of my friends do. That was a big part of my life and a big part of my network. So it was cool to revisit that. He has history in putting together the Brooklyn Hip Hop Festival. If there's any fellow old guys like me who were lovers of hip hop and used to frequent the Brooklyn Hip Hop Festival, you'll enjoy this because there's some cool stories around there. And outside of that, cool little catch up sesh with my boy Ray that you'll be hearing later. I'm gonna deliver some news. We will follow up from the wireless microphone that I mentioned last week. We got a recommendation from an avid listener. Yeah, there's some cool AI news. This is the first time there's like some news about AI that I really enjoyed. It feels like a special way of using AI. That story's coming up. And we got a voicemail. We got a cool voicemail today. I'm still thinking of how I'm going to respond to it because it's a deep one. You're going to catch that at the end of the podcast. But I got to let you guys know we need more voicemails, okay? Because this one's good. I want you to top this one. Send some voicemails that make us think. Something provocative, because today's voicemail is definitely that. To be honest, man, I'm stressing out about this question from this voicemail. Yeah, that's why I'm saving it till the end, because it's intense. But I need you to call in, okay? That number is 646-926-3885. Need you to hit the voicemail. What is the voicemail intro anyways?
Oh, hi. Hello. Greetings. Salutations. John Ray is here. Usually don't tap in on this part of the show, but I had to punch in and let you all know that I had a lot of fun putting together the voicemail message. I'll go ahead and play that right now. No, I'm not going to play it right now. If you want to hear it, you got to call in. Leave us a voicemail. That's 646-926-3885. Back to Rel.
Welcome to Rel and Friends, guys. All right. Rel and Friends, it is the first week of April. Why do I sound like this? I sound like this because I'm tired, guys. I feel like every episode is different. You've heard exhausted Rel, excited Rel, motivational speaker Rel. Right now, that Rel annoys me. Because I just want to rest. I want to chill. I want to relax. I think last time I spoke to y'all, I was in DC. I was filming with Rory and Maul on their visit out there. And you know what's crazy? There was a fight.
We had our first fight. I think the first fight ever in live podcasting history.
We had the first fight.
We did something groundbreaking.
Yeah.
We thought fighting at an R&B show was crazy.
Yeah. No, fighting at a podcast, a live podcast, is like next level. So here's how it happened. First of all, rewind a little bit. The gentleman that was on stage that ended up getting into the fight, and he was talking, whatever. We were off stage, getting ready to go on, waiting to go on. So the gentleman got off. He walks right up to me like, yo, Maul, man, they booed me, man. They booed me off the stage. So I looked at him. I was like, I didn't know what they were doing. So I thought maybe he was trying to rap, spit some bars, and they booed him. I didn't know. I was like, damn, you know, I just gave him the, damn, kid, like, yo, well, you know, hang in there. You know, I gave him one of those. You know what I mean? Keep your head up. Like, yeah. I don't know what to say.
Talk to Rory. He bombs all the time on stage.
Yeah. So as he walks away from me to go back out into the audience, he goes to the side door. He says something that's very familiar. If you're from the hood and you know some shit is about to happen, he said, all right, watch.
I might have canceled the show if I heard that. So,
but I ain't paying no mind.
Like, he's walking to the car to
I'm
get
like,
them.
I know what I watch mean where I come from. Don't know what it means down here in the DMV, right? Mm. So I'm like, okay. He was like, all right, watch. Well, cool. So we go on stage. You start doing our set.
Maybe 10 minutes in, you would say?
Maybe 10 minutes.
Maybe 10.
As we're talking about that, you see people getting up, pushing chairs, but everybody looks like they're looking at the ground. Then we learn the gentleman and the security guard were on the floor tussling. But we didn't think it was a real fight. We thought maybe, you know, somebody's just having words. Oh, no. Then more security started to come and help the other security guard. And as they were picking him up off of his feet, carrying him out, he was still trying to swing on a security guard. And then he went on his IG Live and he...
Well, he broke free. I'll give him some credit. He did break free for like a second and then was quickly yoked up within, I don't know, 4 or 5 seconds after that. He gave a good attempt.
I can't remember the last time I was at an event where there was a fight, and for there to be a fight at a podcast appearance, that is crazy to me. It was fun though. I'm not the fight, but the whole show was fun. It was really cool to see Rory and Maul in action in a live setting. After that, I flew to Vegas, met up with the homies, sang some Jodeci lyrics, which was a lot of fun. I think the average audience member age was 50. It had to be. It definitely looked like it was OG night out. Babysitters made a lot of money that weekend. But I really enjoyed it. And then I came back home and I was right back to work. The week was nonstop grind. And the weekends, my weekends will be busy for the rest of the year as well because my kids are in soccer and music class. So no sleeping in for a very long time. That's okay. I also have a trip to LA coming up at the end of the month. I'll have a 2-day production I'm on, and then I'll probably book one or two extra days. So Los Angeles familia, I will be back. Should I move to Los Angeles? I think I'm finding myself frequenting LA more and more. Do I move there? Let's do a Twitter poll and an Instagram stories survey on whether I should move to LA. But on that note, let's get into some news. Okay, does anyone here listen to Drink Champs with Nori and EFN? One of my favorite podcasts, just because I'm a fan of the legends he interviews. And this Friday's episode was an interview with the DOC. The DOC is one of the original members. I think he was a later member. He was a member of NWA as an MC turned producer. If anyone follows his story, he got in a car accident and lost his voice. But he was known to be one of the best MCs of his time. This is late 80s. There's no telling where his career have gone if he didn't lose his voice. So in the interview, the DOC mentioned he is working on getting his masters back, his song masters. Apparently, he was speaking about an AI opportunity to use AI using his original masters when he had his voice to make new records with his original voice that he lost.
But shit, I'm ready for mine now. You know, I love my guys, but I'm trying to make some new DOC shit.
Right.
Then more music, whether I had an operation or just use this AI opportunity. You know, I haven't figured that out yet.
When you say AI opportunity, you're saying like use the AI for
it'll be his voice. He'll pen it. He could even say it.
I heard Beanie Siegel's trying to do that.
Yeah, I heard that too. I think Siegel reached out to me about that.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's not possible for me unless I get those masters back.
I thought that was amazing to hear. The opportunity to be able to do that. They mentioned Beanie Siegel was looking into that too. And by the way, this is why I love Drink Chimes, because Nori already knew that this type of stuff was happening. That's an AI feature that I'm all for an artist whose voice we loved, we know still has the talent. I'm interested to see where this goes. Let's get him his masters back. It's sounding like he's about to get it back. And apparently you would really need those originals so that the AI can process your voice and be able to create new songs out of that. I do think that the music industry will be the first heavily impacted industry when it comes to AI. And I feel like it's already happening. Like, let's be real, guys. Four bats.
I'll come and slap at 8 p.m. and send a text to your DM. $500 for your fucking hair. $200 for your fucking nails. You running out of shoes to wear. So I bought you another pair. You running out of shoes to wear. So I bought you another pair.
I think he's AI. He's definitely some sort of industry plant. It might be AI. The music is good. It feels a little AI-ish. Let me just do a quick callback when I interviewed Justin, and he kind of hinted that the impact of AI in the music industry is coming really soon, and he seemed terrified. Have you seen anyone messing with Logic's voice and making rap songs with Logic's voice?
Yeah, so... I don't know if I should say this, but a company approached us about like how they could like license it and do it the right way, which I appreciated.
Crazy. So that they're actually thinking about that, huh?
Yeah, that's definitely in motion, man. You saw like the Drake and Kanye single or whatever that came out that was AI.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, there's going to be ways that people incorporate it into everyday life more and more. And it's going to happen quick. It's going to happen really fast. It's happening.
Damn.
Definitely happened.
And my good buddy Boogie Brown texted me and John Reyes about an alternative to that Shure device I mentioned last week that can turn any mic into a wireless system. And I think it was around like $700. $700. Crazy. But sent an alternative. Boogie Brown sent an alternative. It is the X5 U3 wireless microphone system. I'm reading directly off of this Amazon link that he sent over. It is $199. It has 4.5-star reviews, 1,437 reviews. So let's read the AI-generated review. Jeez, everything is AI now. Customers like the performance, sound quality, ease of use,
durability and signal, strength of the wireless audio adapter, for example. They mentioned it works well. The interface is intuitive and the setup is simple. That said, some complain about the strength signal. Okay, thank you, Boogie Brown, for sending that in. I could get 2.5 of them for the price that Shure's trying to charge. $700? Come on, dipshits.
But without further ado, I'm so excited to talk a little architecture, to talk a little hip-hop event, to talk about cool stuff in general. My guy Ray provided a lot of insight on his background. I loved his story. Again, man, the reason why I love doing these interviews is I get a little bit of a deeper background on folks that I've known for a really long time and had no idea about certain things. So this was one of those. Without further ado, let's get into it. My interview with graphic designer, architecture designer, interior designer, event pusher, Ray Herrera. Ray, can you tell me your favorite rap line?
My favorite rap line?
Yeah.
Yeah. Does everybody get stuck on this?
Everyone gets stuck, yes.
Don't cry, dry your eye. Here comes your mom with those two little guys.
Wait, so that's Slick Rick, right?
Slick Rick. When I first started hearing rap, it was starting to tell some stories about the streets and all that kind of stuff. And this was just like a guy having a good time telling silly stories. So Mona Lisa was one of those songs that was like a great story. It was humorous. And then it was a good way to play on lyrics, you know, play on words.
That's right. Yeah, man. My company name is called Art of Storytelling, and it's hugely inspired by Slick Rick because he was one of my favorites growing up.
I didn't do that on purpose, by the way. But yeah, I always thought Slick Rick was, you know, just a master. And also stylistically, and then also painting a picture of getting ready in the morning, like all the shit was together, putting his outfit together. I have some issues with vanity.
We all do, man. We all do.
I said, don't cry. Dry your eye. Here comes your mother with those two little guys.
But welcome to the show, man. Thank you for joining. You're the first of this type of creative that I'm interviewing. Can you introduce yourself and what creative field you're in?
So primarily I'm in architecture and interior design. But when we used to kick it, if someone would ask me that question, it would be hard for me to answer it because I just always wanted to be considered just the creative, period. When we met, I was doing graphics for different marketing companies, sneaker companies. But my first love is architecture, just general visual arts, I would say. Right now, I'm working on the corporate end. I work at a firm that sometimes they take on other designers' work and execute it. So we take their drawings, their design drawings, and we turn them into real buildable designs and then build it. And then we also do projects from scratch where we design it, we present the concept to the client, we create the drawings to bid it, so to send it out to contractors so they can give you pricing and tell you how much it's going to cost, how much time it's going to take to do it. And, you know, then that becomes a negotiation between the people that we're building for and the people who own the land and the Department of Buildings, like New York City Department of Buildings. And so there's a bunch of people to coordinate. So there's also like engineers that do the mechanical, the electrical, plumbing, all that stuff. And so the architect is kind of like the quarterback of that. The project manager is kind of like the quarterback, and that's what I do. So I manage the process of the design through developing that design, through the bidding, through actually building it and making sure that it's built the way that it was specified.
So you're the liaison kind of between the design side and the actual, like, the laborer side, right? The construction side.
Yeah, honestly, I spend more time on the construction because the design portion of it, which is the most fun part, I would say that's about 10% of the whole process. Like, the really fun part where you're just like, all right, why do we do this and why do we do that? That's like a small portion, but even the lead up to that, there's a whole business end where you're like kind of just luring in that client. And there's another team of marketing people that they'll take these people out to dinner and try to figure out what their expectations are and all this other stuff. And then it goes to the designers. And then because I have a very heavy background in design, I get involved in that. But not all people in my position do. Everything goes through the design process and then it gets handed off to someone who's more of a...
just a project manager strictly, yeah. Right?
Yeah. So I teeter on both of those things.
Yeah, because of your design background.
Yeah, and I want to continue doing that. I know what the requirements are to build something. I know all the technical aspects of it, but I want to know it because I want it to have a certain aesthetic value. So that's where I tend to have my focus in. And that's also been a challenge for me in a lot of firms where they'll say, that's not your lane. You're supposed to be over here. But I'd be like, no, but this doesn't look good. This isn't right. And sometimes, even when I'm not asked, I'll just do a whole presentation. I did it once at another firm that I was at a couple years ago, where I just created a presentation that I wasn't asked to create. But I didn't really dig the direction, and the whole concept was like a graffiti concept, and I just went off on it, and it's what we ended up doing.
What do you mean a graffiti concept?
So there's this ping pong club called Spin, and the concept was like an alleyway, like you're playing ping pong in an alleyway, the space was rough looking, and then we invited different graffiti artists to basically tag the walls and put up stuff. I got Okuda from Spain, and then We Are New York. They're more like traditional like taggers and like collage work. And then they ended up getting other artists for the different clubs that they have.
Sick. Man, yeah, your job sounds cool, man. It really sounds like the perfect blend of like art and professional world in a way to really make some real money in a creative space. Okay, yeah, I want to get into your whole history in like the art space. But first, at the beginning of the podcast, I like to share a memory that I have with everyone that I'm interviewing. And the summer we met was the summer I first moved to New York. I linked up with John. He introduced me to you and all the Couch Sessions crew. And that was kind of like, for me, the last of my super party years, man. But it was kind of like going out with a bang because we went hard that year. And I think that might have been like one of the last couple or few summers that Couch Sessions existed, was it, right? So yeah, I remember us putting together cool parties, and specifically it was a Sango show. John put me on to Sango, and then he booked Sango, and then I just remember music was kind of changing at that time. It was like early Selection and everything was like bass or whatever they call it, you know. So it was just a new discovery of new music, and then like meeting a cool crew of creatives. And all of us were like singing all the words to that Sango show. Do you remember that, man?
Yeah. So in those days, I was doing the artwork for those parties that we would put together, but I was also stage managing the shows. You always saw me at those parties running back and forth, getting shit, getting people on and off the stage. I was the guy that like all the artists hated because I'd be like, yo, last song. Yeah, yeah. You know, and Sango was dope, man. It was dope to see a lot of these guys like now still rocking. They're still doing their thing. And it was great to kind of pluck people out of SoundCloud or wherever the hell we found them, and we saw potential and say, yo, this is going to be the next person up. And man, it was such a great time. When you met us, that was like my second creative venture with John, because we actually met at the Brooklyn Hip Hop Festival before that.
Oh, that's right. Can you talk a little bit about the Brooklyn Hip Hop Festival and what you guys did there?
Wes Jackson ran the Brooklyn Hip Hop Festival. He was looking for like a number two, a general manager. But I think the way that the ad went out was that as his assistant. The ad didn't go out as general manager. The economy had just fucking crashed and everybody was looking for something to do. So mad people applied for this job. My aunt from Brooklyn, she knows all the Lyricist Lounge people. Like, she's connected with a bunch of people. She went to high school with a bunch of rappers and shit. And she knew a friend of Wes's. And sent me the ad. I sent in my application thinking, yo, I'm over here doing architecture. I could be some guy's assistant, you know. And I was looking for something. I really needed something to do. We all applied and I didn't get the job, but they asked me to come in because they were like interested in my resume to see if there was another way that they could fit me in. And when I went in, it was all these different like people, like John, who's an attorney. I'm like, yo, who the hell got this job? If I didn't get this job, who the fuck got this job, right? And then I meet John, and I'm like, oh, and after talking to John for like 5 minutes, I'm like, yeah, the right guy got the job, man. This guy knows everything about hip-hop, and he really was in tune with that whole scene at the time, really plugged in and connected. And so it was him. It was like another attorney, Kelly, the company man, Justin Hutt, Run, all of us that you know, still see us once in a while collab with each other and, you know, still friends. We all applied for the same position, and they figured out a place to put us all. And after a couple of years, we just decided to do our own thing, expand from just, you know, straight old school hip hop. And that's how we ended up at Couch Sessions.
Man, can you describe what the Brooklyn Hip Hop Festival was? Because like, this was at the time before everything was a festival. It was so special. I mean, when I was living on the West Coast, I would travel to New York just to go to Brooklyn Hip Hop Festival, man.
Yeah, it started off as like a block party, basically. Like the first one they did was just a street party. They would close out a couple streets and then, you know, whatever little rappers would come in, they would do their thing. And then it just evolved into this machine where, you know, we had a volunteer force. So most of us didn't get paid to do what we did. We just kind of came in the first year. You filled in an application to volunteer. They put you in your spot. But it was good because you got to network with all these people. You got to meet all your favorite rappers, and they would pair, you know, OGs of hip hop, you know, somebody big who's a headliner. And then that person helps to curate the big bulk of the show. And then that gets paired with every year, Duck Down. There's somebody from Duck Down, or the whole Duck Down Records is there. So you could kind of consider Duck Down partners, you know. Jay Period would do like his mixtape. He's still doing those now, but he used to do those like a live mixtape. He would just gather five or six rap groups and do his mixes and have rappers perform it live. And people were paying, I don't know, I think the first year I did was like $10. It was like nothing.
That's like getting into a nightclub or a bar. You know?
Yeah, and then the week leading up to that, we had a bunch of events. So every day was a different event up until that Saturday that was a hip-hop festival. So Monday was like a film night, like hip-hop film, or, you know, we would curate a different night that has a different hip-hop-related theme that's a part of the culture. It was a dope time, man. Like, a lot of times I was the guy, like I said, managing the shows, and I would be at the door, and I would get to greet the artists, and it was an incredible experience, man. I ended up the second year that I was doing it as the art director. So I went from like helping out to doing little flyers to like being the art director of the festival.
I forgot that you're also just a general graphic designer too. So let's rewind. I just want to go to kind of like the beginning. Can you talk about where you're from and then the early influence of the culture that really got you into the arts?
So I'm from Puerto Rico. My parents are Dominican, but I was born and raised in Puerto Rico until I was 10 years old. In Puerto Rico, my dad had a camera shop. So if we're going to talk about like my early influences in creativity, I would say my dad and his friends. You know, I grew up in a dark room. My dad had a little camera shop, a dark room in the back. And this was the days when we were still developing film by hand. And I remember when they first got the first digital machine, it was like bigger than my living room. And then at the end of the thing, it was like a conveyor belt thing. The pictures would come out. So we had, I think, one of the first machines on the island. My dad had those first machines, and then he ended up having to expand that. So I grew up drawing and playing instruments and just being creative. My parents really encouraged creativity. There was an architect that lived down the street from us, and all of our houses looked kind of the same except for his. His looked a little different, had a second story. At his office, he had an atrium in his living room. And I just thought, wow, this is the coolest dude in the neighborhood. I want to be just like this guy when I grew up, right? So I don't know what the fuck happened in the late 80s where all of a sudden we just had to leave. It was like little by little, all the furniture and all the shit from my house is disappearing. So my dad was selling. I wasn't like totally aware what the fuck was going on. I was 10 years old. And then he's like, yo, we're moving to New York. It felt to me like all of it happened within a month where we had furniture. I had a whole life. And then everything's gone. It's September and I'm freezing my ass off in Passaic, New Jersey, in the hood. I'm 10 years old. And my parents had just had mad kids. And where we were in Puerto Rico, you couldn't really do the public schools. You had to do the private schools. And I think it got really tight for them. So they were just like, you know what? Let's get the fuck out of here. We ended up in a two-bedroom apartment, four adults and six children, two of my cousins and four kids, and my mom was pregnant. And then we got our own apartment, two bedrooms, and then five children, and then became six children. So we were in a two-bedroom with six kids, and then we moved to housing projects in Passaic. So through all that, I was in band. I started off in violin, then I played drums. But I was always drawing. I was like the artist, I would say. Like, it got me out of a lot of trouble in the hood. Like, all the kids that wanted to beat me up, once they found out I could draw, like, oh, yo, draw me Run DMC, draw me this, draw me that. We went from that to like eighth grade. When we started throwing parties, I was the guy hand drawing the flyers and helping my boy promote the party. So, you know, I've been throwing parties, like all that stuff you saw me do with John. That was like a culmination of all those skills together. When I really started taking art school seriously and design seriously, I kind of put the graphics and the party life aside. And it wasn't until that year when the economy crashed and I was looking for something, what I really found was myself, like my old self. Like all these things when I was a kid, when I was younger, I'm like, yo, this is the guy I want to be. I don't want to just be, you know, a dude with a job wearing fucking, you know, button down and whatever. That's what I was becoming. And it was because of that economy crash, I was looking to reinvent myself, where it was almost like it wasn't a reinvention. It was like a full circle, like going back to those things that excited me as a youth and all that.
For sure, for sure. So what was that job that you had when you felt like you were becoming that button-up guy in a corporate space? I've definitely felt that myself.
Honestly, that's where I am now, but I figured out a niche in that corporate world to still be myself, you know, and they accept it, which is great. And they're supportive of me. But I would say it was what I was doing high-end residential. It wasn't really a corporate thing, but what you're dealing with is the people who run these type of places. And it wasn't satisfying, man. Like, some of those clients were good people, but some of them were not. Some of them were demanding in an unfair way. Some of them you can tell that their hearts weren't in the right place and it just didn't feel right, you know. I would see them buy a dining table that was my salary for the year and it just didn't feel good. It was creative. That's what I love about it. And, you know, that's what kept me in it for so long, was that the creative part of it. But it just didn't, like, I don't know. I saw the way I was dressing every day and I was trying to become something that I really wasn't. And I never felt comfortable. And it's almost like every time I've done that, where I've tried to fit in somewhere, it never works out. Like, you got to figure out a place where you could just 100% be yourself.
Yeah, or find a nice, like, middle. That's what I've realized. I did have a job for a while where I felt like I was doing a lot of code switching, you know what I mean? Where you're just, like, trying to talk their language or look like them or be interested in what they're interested in, and it never felt right. I think after a few, or actually maybe 5-10 years, I figured out how to be myself around that environment. And I think that's a hard thing to do, man, especially when you come from a cultural space, you know what I'm saying? So, okay, the whole time growing up, like, what was going on around you as far as music?
So Puerto Rico at the time in the 80s, I grew up in this neighborhood called Balboa in Puerto Rico. It was just a hood. And down the street was this famous salsa singer called Frankie Reese. My parents worked so many hours that they sent me to this babysitter. The lady who took care of me, she was like a lot into like Mexican boleros. So it's like the slow Spanish ballads, those kind of things. My dad was listening to a lot of old school merengue and salsa. The newer stuff that was coming in, maybe like after 86, he wasn't really listening to that. So that was like what I was listening to in my family. And then the people around me were listening to like pop music and not really hip hop. I spent 2 summers in Brooklyn, in Cobble Hill. So my grandma, my aunts, they all live in Cobble Hill. So I spent the summer of 84 and 85 there. In 84, the first year I came, I was a little ass kid. My aunt took me to the movie theater to see Beat Street, and it changed my life. Like, I came back to Puerto Rico like a different person that year. I was looking for rap, but it wasn't really there. You would see people like portray it in like little comedy skits and things like that, but you couldn't really find it. The oldest son of the lady who took care of us, he listened to rap a little bit. So that was my only access to hip hop, was him. And then everything else was whatever. So I spent that summer, 84 and 85, in Brooklyn. And that was my connection to that. And all the kids on that block, they were a lot of breakdancers. So there was on one side of Cobble Hill, those were all the Puerto Rican kids. A lot of them were breakers. And then down the street was all the Italian kids. And even then, there was something like hip-hop about them, and those two kind of like clashed, and they would fight all the time. But my aunt was friends with all the Puerto Rican and black kids from that side of Cobble Hill, and they would, like, you know, try to take me under their wings and, like, you know, get me interested in dancing. And so I came back home, cardboards on the floor, and would start, like, breaking and dancing and all that kind of shit. But when I came here, it was like, again, I was in the hood, and I came from Puerto Rico with a violin, and I had to drop that right away because I thought somebody's going to break it over my head. You know, like, you can't be walking around the hood with a violin, man. It just didn't work. So I switched to drums. I started playing drums when I came to Jersey, to Passaic, and I played drums all up until I got serious in college when I was 21 is when I got serious, and I just couldn't do both design and music. And I was in like a metal band, I was in a blues band, I was like in a hip hop, I would say something similar to the Roots, somewhere between the Roots and Rage Against the Machine was our band. We called ourselves Seven Wing Butterfly.
Okay.
Like a weed leaf. What? It was just something stupid. Oh, okay.
But that's hilarious.
Seven Wing Butterfly. Dumb.
I like that.
But yeah, so the last band that I was in was a Mexican band. They're playing like cumbia, rancheras, all those kind of things. And that was a band called Malicia. And we were, you know, well known in our area. And then that band turned into another band called Ginger Molly that was better known in the East Coast and some parts of Mexico.
Man, I didn't know artistically like how broad you are, like in music. It's not even like just hip hop or anything. I mean, I knew your taste is broad because we would listen to all kinds of shit together. But I didn't know you actually played all that, which is dope to hear. All right, listen up, guys. I'm sorry to do this. I gotta take a quick break from this interview to let you guys know about something very special I have going on. About 3 years ago, I created this company called Art of Storytelling. And basically, what we do is we sell cassette tapes of Slick Rick's The Art of Storytelling. Just kidding. So I run a full-service production company. We do everything from ideation, pre-production, production, post-production. Very much geared around solving problems through storytelling. So the next time you're in a brainstorm meeting with your boss and he says, we need to create a video to create impact or to make a splash for some sort of initiative, send him my way. I promise you'll be the hero. You'll be the office hero once they get that beautifully shot vertical video that everyone watches on their phones. Hit me up. Rel.mov on IG. Chances are I have a video that you need already. Let's talk it through. All right, back to the program. So you've obviously done a lot of contract work in your time as well, right? Like just looking for gigs where you can. That's a good segue into the segment I have called For the Love of Money. For the Love of Money is a segment that I hope to encourage money talk around creative professional, creative work. In your history of all creative stuff that you do, where do you find like makes the most money for you?
What I'm doing right now.
Yeah, architectural.
Yeah, and if I were to start my own firm, that's where the most potential is. Like working for someone, you'd have to like really set your roots down at a firm and become a part of that company's complete culture in order to get a compensation that kind of makes sense for everybody, which I understand. Like, you know, when you invest all your resources in your company into a person, you got to make sure that they're either really, really there or, you know, you're picking someone with super high demand skills, right? So, I mean, I know that I have my limitations. As you know, about personality, I kind of keep my hands in all different types of bags, right? I try to spread out my creative energy in all kinds of different places. So it's been the same, even in architecture itself. A lot of people that I work with, they've only done corporate design, for instance, or they've only done hospitality or only done residential. For me, I kind of get bored or whatever it is, and then I want to go and learn the next thing. So I've been doing corporate design now for 4 years, and I feel like a junior. Even though I'm a senior, you know, in position and in experience and all that stuff, I still feel like I've only been doing this for a couple of years because I have. Every aspect of design is a little bit different. But where we make the most money, I would say, is where I am right now doing corporate work with your own firm. And secondly, products. I know that the royalties that you get in creating a product like a carpet or a piece of furniture or, you know, some kind of a product, that's where a lot of the money is. So a lot of these big architects, it's not just in their fees. You know, the bigger architects, they get huge fees for their work, but a lot of it is on the collaboration that they have with other companies.
So product-wise, their designs include specific products that they get a cut on?
Yeah, and a lot of times they're not even developing that product from start to finish. You're kind of putting your stamp on it, or you're working with a company, or sometimes they're even just licensing your name as a designer and like kind of creating the product for you. But there are architects that absolutely, they work on the process from the beginning to the end. And there's a firm that I work for that also had part ownerships in some of these companies that they're doing the collaboration with. So they really have a stake in the products that they're creating. I know Target a couple of years ago was doing a couple of collaborations with like designers, or Virgil Abloh doing stuff with IKEA. Like that shit makes you money.
That's crazy. Yeah, I remember that IKEA thing too. God, there was lines at IKEA for that, which is crazy, man. Yeah. To dive a little bit deeper into this kind of money area, from your experience of working in architectural design in like corporate or residential or whatever spaces, like what makes the most money?
If I were to look at the companies that I work for, who seems like they have the most money? I would have to say the people doing hospitality, like they have the most luxurious lifestyle. But what I don't know is if I got that wrong and the corporate guys are making the most money, but they're the most conservative when it comes to their own lifestyles. The corporate guys, I think a lot of those firms are like sausage factories in that they just pump out mad work, right? And their fees are not that big, but they're pumping out a lot of work, right? So maybe at the end of the day, when you look at the numbers, the corporate guys are making the most money. But when you look at the interior design magazine, when they come out like with the top 100 firms, the top ones are always the corporate ones. The ones they bill the most up from the year are the corporate ones, and then they pepper in hospitality.
Okay, okay. Hospitality is kind of like you have to live that lifestyle also to be credible in that the hospitality space. I've noticed that because I did a contract with a hotel before, and all of them are all about like down to like the thread sheet count of their beds, and we'd be going out, hanging out, and they're just living that life, man. It's funny that you say that.
It looks like the hospitality guys make the most money, but I feel like the corporate guys make the most.
Yeah. They're about the money. They're really about the money. So in all your history of creative work, whether it's like graphic design, doing a cool party in a band, or even just the 9 to 5, what was a big L moment? Like a big, like, damn, I fucked up kind of moment for you that sticks out?
I have a couple, but I have one. God damn. So I was working on the two flagship hotels for Hilton. They had this line called Canopy. So I was one of the designers that developed their first two hotels and their design standards. So we basically designed everything, even their cups, like every single part of their brand we designed, from graphics to the thread count. I was on a deadline. I'm supposed to send the final bid drawings on whatever that deadline date was. And I was like half asleep when I was doing it, and I picked a folder from all of the comments that they told them. They were like very adamant. Look, I need this, 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 and this change. I just picked from the wrong folder, sent it out, and had a whole presentation, and everybody's looking at the wrong thing.
Oh, man. So wait, this was in front of a bunch of people?
Oh, yeah, yeah. And one of the head guys at Hilton. I realized it while we were in the conversation, and I'm like, boop, I sent it. And then it was too late. So I ended up being let go from this job.
Because of that?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah,
man.
Like, it was a big L.
So you had the work done. You just submitted the wrong folder.
Yeah, it just makes you look bad. It makes you look like you're not paying attention. And, you know, maybe the guy also had it out for me for something else. Because when they sat me down, they were like, hey, you know, we've gotten a couple of complaints from your clients. And I was like, clients with an S? It wasn't clients. Because it was another job that they wanted me to do something I didn't want to do. And my boss and I at that place where we kind of butting heads. And then when I made that mistake, it was a wrap. But honestly, the reason why I was spending, you know, all those late nights was because I was trying to juggle the other stuff that I was doing. You know, like putting those parties together. I was just trying to do too much. And that's a thing we get into in New York, especially, you know, when you're in that stage of your career between your 20s and your 30s, when you're like in that stage where you're no longer the kid that's learning things. Now you're like transitioning into the more experienced, tempered designer or creative or whatever, professional, let's say. Sometimes, you know, you try to take on more than you know that you can handle, and you think you can, and you think you're invincible. And
yeah, I still do that, man. I still take on a lot of work, man.
I would say that maybe since the pandemic, I've kind of slowed down. I feel like I've slowed down.
Yeah, that's good. That big L moment, what was the lesson learned from that specific moment?
Oh, man, I don't even know that there was a lesson to be learned other than that. I just need to prioritize my sleep.
That's a big lesson learned, yeah.
I never did, bro. I thought about so many successful people. You know, they don't sleep. Like Voltaire drinking 50 cups of coffee, or so they say. So, yeah, just never prioritize that rest period. Because your brain needs that time to, like, recover and to, like, kind of step back. And I'm still struggling with that, honestly.
It's probably the most important thing health-wise that you could do is sleep. I mean, of course, exercise and a good diet is good. But, like, sleep, that'll take you a long way, man. If you get, like, 8 hours of sleep every night, like, you feel 100% the next day. And I had to learn that, too. Because, like, the culture tells you, like, dude, like my favorite album of all time is Illmatic, and Nas says, "I don't sleep because sleep is the cousin of death." You know what I mean? And it's just kind of like telling you, like, we grind 24/7. It's like, no, you can't do that, man. You're just going to burn yourself out, you know, especially as a creative. Like, we can't be doing that. We got to let our brains reset. So I think that's a great lesson learned.
I'm in my 40s now, so it used to be easier to do. Like, now it's like...
Yeah, also, yeah, we're getting older, man. Like, we need longer time to recover. Like, we can't just go binge drinking and then sleep 2 hours and then go to a 9-to-5 job anymore, man. I used to do some shit like that. You know what I mean? And be cool by noon, I'd be cool, you know? But yeah, we can't be doing that anymore. So to contrast that, what is a big W moment for you? Like, a big win moment where you felt like, all right, yeah, I did some dope shit right here.
The restaurant that I just finished last year, I would say, was one of my better accomplishments. I did a renovation to Manhattan, which is at 28 Liberty, the 60th floor. So we added a bar and some event spaces, and it just came out really beautiful. So it's one of my favorite design accomplishments. But my biggest W was that weekend that you talked about, the Sango party. That was one of my biggest W's that whole weekend, because I was still in that space where I was like struggling finding something permanent. So for maybe about 3 years, I was doing like temp work mostly. I would start off with a month contract, and then they extend it for another month, they extend it for another month. And then I'd be like, give me something or let me go. And like a lot of times they don't want to pay the health insurance or whatever it is. And they would just find the next temp. And it was that way for many years. And that weekend I had like 4 interviews lined up. One of them was in a firm in Orlando. It's a big corporate firm. And they were going to hire me to work on fucking supermarkets, which would have killed me, but I needed a job. I was living in Fort Lauderdale. So all that stuff that we were doing, I was doing all of that out of my bedroom in Fort Lauderdale. And then I'd fly to New York or fly to Austin or whatever it was, all that shit that we were doing, I was doing it out of Florida. So I set up an interview to this place in Orlando on Wednesday. And then for Wednesday, I was going to fly to New York because we were doing that party. That party was my birthday weekend as well. So it was going to be lit. I was going to go up and chill with my friends, and it's my birthday, and then throw a dope-ass party with Sango and a bunch of different artists. So that Wednesday, after I flew to Orlando, I got a call to interview at Yabo Pushelberg, which is a really dope firm. I still love a lot of the people there. And so that weekend, I got this job. I had on my dope-ass suit, my Men in Black skinny tie suit. Got that job. And then that weekend, just party with my people. It was just like an amazing time.
Let me jump into another segment. It's called Scope Creeps. Scope creep is a term where like a project might increase in scope over time, where there is no like conversation about money or time compensation. Have you ever dealt with anything like that in the architectural design world?
I actually have a client like that now, where we started off like, hey, I just need you to do this and this and that. I go to the owner like, hey, they asked me to do this, but last year they did the same thing, and then they kept on asking me to change things and add things and do more things and do more things. He's like, don't worry about it. So I think certain firms, like in this one, I don't make those kind of decisions as to whether or not we take on the client, whether or not we charge them more. because I'm not privy to the nuances of like the levels above me. I just kind of leave it up to the other people. Sometimes if it's something that I could like just knock out just because I want to maintain a relationship, I'll do it. And this takes experiences, knowing where that limit is, where you know you're getting taken advantage of. And then you got to be like, nah, you got to kind of put a pause on it. In my own, the stuff that I've done on my own privately, it happens, but I don't really play around with it. Like, I always worked on contract basis. And the stuff that you saw me work on, like in the music space and all that, it wasn't really contract. So I would do certain things just to maintain a relationship. But you got to know your limit. You got to put your foot down, man, because like your time is precious, man. It's all we have, really. Your time is so precious and you just can't be giving it away like that for free, you know. But that took years and it took a lot of, you know, like just digging in and trying to find your balls to like be like, no.
Yeah. And it's hard because I found that it's usually in like the culture space where those limits are pushed. And you want to do it because you love it so much. But then it's like you said, man, your time is precious. You're like, your mental health is precious. Like, your health is precious. So like, you got to like really take charge of that.
But that probably happened a lot more when I was starting off, because somebody is kind of giving you that opportunity and you wouldn't really have that opportunity otherwise. And they know that. They know that you need the shot, right? So the people who are really good at it, they push, you know, up until that limit.
And when you're young, you know, that's your way in the door, man. You got to do it. But as you get older, it's like, I don't do this shit anymore, man.
Yeah,
word. Okay, so there's some quick rapid fire questions to end this. First question is, major or independent? I know you're with a company now, but you've also worked independently. What do you prefer? Or what have you had the best experience in, like working for a company or working independently?
For smaller firms. The firm that I'm at right now is in the top 100. It doesn't feel like it. It feels like a small place because you get to do a little bit of everything. And when they hired me, they kind of presented it as, you can kind of make this job whatever you really want it to be. And it's really been the case. That's why I'm still there. As long as you know, you're doing your thing, they give you your space to develop your career the way you kind of want to develop it. And so that's why this job still feels natural to me. But I've always liked 10 people tops. Those have been like my favorite experiences. Like, it's just a small team. Everybody has their own little project and everything just feels more personal.
It's just enough people where you don't get spread too thin and, you know, not too many people where it just feels like too many cooks in the kitchen, right?
Yeah, because I've had some situations like that where, like you said, too many cooks in the kitchen. That also doesn't work. It's like, you know, sometimes you have input that's not really necessary, or like if one person in the chain doesn't understand the mission or the goal, you're wasting time trying to figure out how to make everybody understand and be on the same page on this chain. And sometimes it's not even necessary. Sometimes I can see where this is going to land anyway. I'm like, this is going to end up here anyway. I wasted my time explaining this other shit to you. And so there's this guy, Oppenheim. I love his work and the way he built his firm. He's this architect out of Miami. And he's building skyscrapers now, but he started off like doing these small buildings, renovating small buildings himself. So he was his own developer. So he didn't have to go to some other guy or some other team to go get an answer. He had the answer himself right there. And this process was so goddamn efficient. He ended up extremely successful, you know, and I wish I could do something like, well, one day. That's my goal. That is my goal eventually, is to see if I can do my own thing at some point.
That's dope. I like that, man. So speaking of future, what does the next 5 years look like to you?
So I've been connecting a lot with Puerto Rico lately. When I left in 87, I never went back. So my family's all Dominican, right? So I go to DR with fiance. She want to go check out Bad Bunny. Three years ago, we went And then I ended up staying an extra week just by myself.
I bet it was so lit out there for Bad Bunny.
Yeah, it was dope. I'm not even like a Bad Bunny fan or anything like that. But that shit was so dope. And then he did this video at the beginning where it was like a love letter to the island. And I fell apart when I saw that video. I was like, damn, yo. Like, it just brought back all these memories of, being a kid here. And then I was like, nah, I'm staying. So I did a Motorcycle Diaries type of trip by myself. Went around the island, went back to my hometown. I went to my neighborhood. I went to look for my friends. Everybody had moved. It was 34 years later. So everybody had moved out. There was nobody there. But I did see the old lady that raised me. I went to the jungle by myself, which is the dumbest thing. I went in like thinking I'm going in here for a day hike with my fucking stupid ass Yeezy slides. it was horrible, but it was a great experience. They're developing shit out of this country. There's hotels, boutique hotels, Airbnbs, all kinds of shit like that. A lot of people are doing that. Why not? Why not me? Within 5 years, I want to at least start that process of my own home. What I'm thinking is, having some kind of a development firm that I can do work here and over there, and maybe DR also, because most of the people doing this kind of work, they're buying up properties and they're not from there. They're pricing out the locals out of everything. I went to a supermarket and they wanted me to pay $8 for a box of grapes. It's a tropical island. Why is stuff like this happening? I want to get back there and help. I'm going to get back to Puerto Rico and DR and help a little bit and then still see if I can keep my life here, because I just don't see myself leaving here. I'm stuck here. It's like the culture, my friends. I don't want to leave. I'm not saying this because I want to leave. I don't want to leave. I wish I had the desire to leave here because it's hard.
Yeah, man. Yeah. I feel you, man. Next question. If you could say anything to the young you, what would it be?
If I could say anything to the young, this is almost as hard as the hip hop line question. Don't give up. Don't ever give up. Because I've gotten through, so many points where I've wanted to, and I'm like, fuck, man. So I'm very thankful that my kids came along, because they kind of helped me stay focused, because I got to leave something for them.
For sure.
Not even something financial, at least my dad was that guy.
Did this. Exactly. Yeah, I would say having kids, you do enter a new level of motivation where it becomes not just about you, but more about your legacy and what you can pass on through the family. And you start making smarter decisions too. Okay, next question. AI, do you fear it or do you use it?
Well, all right, so somebody at my job used it for a presentation. I was so pissed off when I heard that they did, because you're saying that you're not as important, because what you do, I can type into a machine to create it. There's a lot of stuff that AI does that's weird. The same stuff that you see with six fingers, when you see an AI rendered interior, we can see all the six fingers of design. So it's not something that's set up yet, but this is just the beginning, man. It almost makes it feel like my job at some point could be obsolete. I'm sure a lot of jobs are going to be manufacturing jobs, farming jobs, all those things could be at some point, run by robotics. And then manual labor won't be a thing anymore. So, I can't be afraid of the future. It's the future. It's here. It's going to happen. I want to get into using it because I don't want to get left behind. I'm not on it yet, but I do want to get into using it, because I've seen some stuff that, I could take just at least for conceptual, ideas. But I just think that the AI is going to create its own consciousness and take us out anyway, so.
Yeah, man.
No, I don't know.
You just scared me with that last sentence. But yeah, AI, I do know some creatives that have started using it in their workflow. I've dabbled with it, but I haven't found a way for it to really be integrated in the way I work. But I know some people that get a lot of work done using AI too. So not yet for me. Okay, and then we'll close it off with this final segment called Drop a Gem on Them. Once again. Man, if there's any kind of inspirational words you could get, anyone trying to get into design or architectural design or any kind of the creative spaces that you've been in, any gems you could drop on them?
Yeah, don't ever forget your love for what you're doing, because that's what's going to keep you there. You know, I know I went to school with some people that they were just like, oh, this seems like an interesting thing that I could probably do. And 9 times out of 10, those people don't stay in the space, or they're in the space, but they're like vendors, like carpet vendors or stone vendors or something like that. Like, there's so many things that you can get into than architecture or in graphic design. Like, in graphic design, you can be doing logos, or you can work for a company creating their labels or whatever it is. So your love is going to keep the job that you're doing pure, no matter what. Like Terry Crews is talking about, like, oh, when he was a janitor, he was like sweeping the shit out of the floors because he felt like, I'm paraphrasing, but it was something, do your job as if they're paying you $1 million, because it's going to keep you focused on your goals. It's going to keep your discipline up, because you're not always going to be doing the thing that you dreamed that you were going to be doing, right? You're not going to be doing the creative work that you necessarily pictured doing, but maybe this thing is going to take you to that opportunity that's going to take you to where you're going to, you know, be doing the thing that you want to be doing eventually, right? So yeah, I think that's a good one. Like, for whatever you're doing, do it as if you're getting paid $1 million to do it, man.
Like, dope. Yeah, great way to end it, man. That was a great gem. But yeah, man, thank you again. Yeah, until next time, man. So till we randomly meet at another venue.
I know.
And that was it. That was the interview with my boy Ray, and it was a nice one, man. It was an unexpected nice one. Not that my boy Ray is not expected to give a good interview, but because I realized a few things. I remember at the time we were both going through a transitional period in our lives, but I don't think I really appreciated that part of it. And that all goes back to remembering that you gotta like be present in the journey and acknowledge the things that are going on presently and be in the moment. But it was a special time, and it was also cool to hear that one of the events that we all helped put together was a major turning point in his life. So that was really cool to hear. But before we go, we gotta jump into the voicemails.
Calling, I'm calling my brother, I'm calling. Answer your phone, I'm calling. Conversation. My words connect, my mind connects to your, and we connect. Answer.
Hey Rel, this is Mel. For context, my design team always does weekly icebreakers with Would You Rathers. Our most recent one was, would you rather have to fight a kangaroo or shark? We all chose kangaroo. Now my question to you, being a creative professional specializing in cinematography and now podcasts, would you rather have to lose your sight or hearing, and why?
Okay, Mel. Is this my friend Mel? I can't tell from the voice. I have a couple male friends. But this question, you sound like a very nice person, Mel, but this is probably the most evil question someone can ask me. Let me first revisit your would you rather. Would you rather fight a kangaroo or a shark? And your whole team chose kangaroo, like it was that easy. Have you seen those things? You seen how buff kangaroos are? I would probably fight a shark over a kangaroo. Maybe not. Yeah, that's a hard one. But the way you said kangaroo, I think you got kangaroos fucked up. But would I rather lose my sight or hearing? Let's talk this through. The hearing. I think some of the biggest influences of my life came through music. Through hip-hop, as I probably say the word hip-hop like 20 times an episode. Without my hearing, it's the backbone for all creative inspiration. It influences how I edit videos. It influences my mood, my behaviors. I use music to chill, to get me hyped up.
to reminisce, to think. So that would be tough. Okay. My vision. Everything I produce is visual. Filming, holding a camera. I got to see things to shoot, to film, to capture. Editing. I look at things a lot. I'm using my vision all the time. So if I had to choose an answer for this most evil question, I would have to say I would give up. I'd probably give up my hearing. Oh, that sounds so depressing. But yeah, I think that's my answer. Oh, man. Yeah, I don't like this question. John, why do we play this one? Mel's banned from the show. Mel, you can no longer call in. Or Mel, you have to call back in and ask a nicer one. Okay? And I need everyone else to call in too, to first get angry at Mel for that mean question, because I don't want to lose either one. And leave your own voicemail. The number is 646-926-3885. You can also send a voice note to relandfriendspod@gmail.com. And you can also have yourself a lovely week. This is another episode of the Rel of Friends podcast. Shout out to John Reyes just because. Peace!